from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point.
You know, every now and then, I think you might like to hear something from us. Nice, pleasing. There's just one thing.
Job down in the city.
You see, we never, ever do nothing.
Working for the man.
Nice.
Every night and
easy.
Day.
We always
but
do it.
I never lost
nice.
One minute
and rough.
And
but we're going to take the beginning of this song and do it
been.
Easy.
Big wheel keep
but then we're
going to
do the finish.
Turning.
Rough.
Proud Mary,
the way we
keep
do.
On burning.
Proud Mary. And we're rolling.
Ooh, rolling.
Ooh,
rolling on the river.
Listen to the story. Left a good job
down in the city.
And we did listen to proud, strong women like Tina Turner singing her Grammy Award-winning cover of Proud Mary back in 1971. To Elvis when he shook and twisted out of the macho straitjacket of the 1950s, to a generation of rock and roll from the top of the charts to lesser-known classics that challenged how American men and women looked at gender, looked at each other, and looked at themselves. Rock music has always meant rebellion, but our guest tonight says that when it comes to the question of gender, rock music, more than almost any other medium, pushed the boundaries of sexual politics in profound ways. Rock and roll, he says, made us better men and women, better parents, better partners, and better citizens. This hour, we'll look at his case and listen to the music. Tonight on Point, gender-bending rock and roll, how music revolutionized American sexual identities and American culture.
On the riverboat queen, big wheel, keep on turning.
Joining me now in the studio is Tim Riley, music commentator and author of the new book, Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. Tim Riley, great to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here, Tom.
So there is the great Tina Turner. You put her right up there with Elvis Presley, and you say, these are the two who took rock and roll and changed the way Americans thought about sexuality, understood their own sexuality, maybe forever, certainly for decades. Make your case. What are you saying about rock and roll and how we understand he and she?
Well, what I'm saying is that rock and roll completely revolutionized ideas about the ideal man and the ideal woman through figures like Elvis Presley and Tina Turner, and then completely altered the way people began behaving and relating to each other. So there were not only new men and women walking around, but they had new idealized versions of the romantic partners they wanted to woo. So men idealized different kind of women, and women idealized different kind of men. And you had a dialogue that went across. And it seemed to me that a lot of the books that had been written about gender in rock and roll were mostly from the focus of, you know, the women in rock. You would see a lot of book titles.
Janet.
Right. And this was the year of the woman, you would hear over and over and over again. But what I was really interested in was what was the new man all about? Because it seemed to be a significant break from the old macho John Wayne style of manhood in Elvis Presley. But also, what was the dialogue that occurred? How were they talking differently to one another? And it was really fascinating to dive into the rock catalog and find all these different ideas alive still in the music.
And you start essentially with Elvis. I mean, 54, 55, he jumps up on that stage. He shakes his hips. You say it shattered prevailing notions about masculinity and femininity so completely that they never recovered, set off a wave of psychosexual change that washed over the American consciousness and has yet to ebb.
Well, exactly. And most rock commentators and rock history people will look at the phenomenon of Elvis through a number of different lenses that we've just come to accept as the norm. One is the racial lens. He was a white boy who was adopting the black stylings and the black rhythms of R&B. He was also a Southern boy who was clearly out to conquer the world. And there was this class thing about him being a Southern sort of white trash, you know, that that the white trash boy could conceive himself to be king of entertainment.
Even a god
was a radical idea.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also this, you have the geographical element, and you also have the class. Then you have the demographics, right? So he's part of the baby boom generation. He's rising up and saying, you know, there's all these established mores that the World War II generation has tried to pass on to us, and we just want to reject them all. We just don't believe in that, you know, no sex before marriage. I mean, that was clearly one of the first things that happened with Elvis, was that the idea of sexuality just kind of came out of the closet.
Right? came blasting out.
And that was why he was only photographed from the waist up on Ed Sullivan and all that stuff.
Let's just bring Elvis back to our ears and go on into that. Of course, Lonesome Tonight, 1960. Are You Lonesome Tonight?
Are you lonesome tonight? Do you miss me tonight? Are you sorry we drifted apart? Does your memory stray to a bright summer day when I kissed you and called you sweetheart?
Oh, that king. We're talking tonight with Tim Riley, author of Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you remember when men were John Wayne and women were Peggy Lee? Do you credit Elvis and Tina and Smokey and Mick Jagger with unlocking gender roles in America? Women, when you heard Proud Mary, did it give you a glimpse of a bigger way of being? Men, when Elvis shook it like a Polaroid picture, did it make all men more free? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tim Riley, okay, here's a very tender man. Was this really such a break with the past? I mean, Frank Sinatra had sung tender songs and many others.
Well, of course, Frank Sinatra, everyone pushes back with Frank Sinatra. But Frank Sinatra, his whole persona was of a very tough, macho guy and as a womanizer. I mean, and he subscribed a great deal to the John Wayne code. The starkest way that I can dramatize the difference is if you try to imagine John Wayne singing this song, you get something very peculiar going in your head. Or even John Wayne pitching woo to a woman in a tender love scene in a movie. I mean, it just does not exist in the John Wayne catalog. Elvis Presley was stepping forward and very aggressively saying, I want to show a tender side. I want to show some expressive, tender, vulnerable emotions. I mean, showing vulnerable emotions was completely, radically against the John Wayne idea.
You're saying never mind Elvis the pelvis and the shaking hips. His whole approach to the opposite sex was new stuff.
Well, very new stuff, and to show his feminine side. Now, for sure, you know, you have Frank Sinatra certainly aware of his feminine side and exploiting that and delivering romantic songs and pitching woo to women. But Elvis, the entirety of the persona, the aggressive pelvic thrusts combined with the tender side, that is what is completely new.
Of course, on the other side, we heard Tina at the top of the hour, and There's the female counterpart, you're saying. How do you describe what Tina Turner brought to this gender-bending form?
Well, when we listen to Proud Mary, I mean, what we're listening to there in that wonderful, seductive opening to that single that Tina gives, which is basically...
And you've just got to listen to her narration.
Yeah,
you cannot get away from
it. But what is that all about? I mean, it's a very sexual kind of seduction she's giving you.
Tender,
we never do anything nice and easy. She's saying, come over, sit down beside me. We like to get rough.
And of course, we now know it's Ike behind her there, and right. Ike was too rough.
Well, that's part of her whole story, is overcoming Ike Turner. Just to set it in historical context for a minute, it's 1971 before she has her first top 10 hit with this cover of Proud Mary. But she had her first hit in 1960, so it took her 11 years just to get that hit, just to get into the top 10. And she still had to portray herself as subservient to Ike, who is the leader of the band and the arranger of the songs and the producer and all of that stuff. So, and she had to wear these very elaborate wigs, and the stage costume was very, you know, sexy and flirtatious.
And she had to do it, not because Ike might smack her if she didn't, though maybe, but because the public still expected it then.
Well, exactly. She had to conform to everyone's idea of what a black woman was going to look like and sound like and act like. And one of the great scenes from the Ike and Tina Turner, the biopic that came out, was when he first hears her in a club and he sits down and he's aghast at what a great singer she is. And he says to her, "You sing like a man." I mean, she sings with great ferocity, you know.
And power, with the, power.
Right. And it's the aggressive, and it's that bottled lightning that was Tina Turner that had a kind of a male energy to it. Well, that was quite radical. And, of course, and it took a long time for culture to begin to accept that. And so by 1971, they're ready to make her a star. But it took a long time. She was an insider favorite for a long time. Mick Jagger famously invites them to open for their 1969 tour, which, of course, is one of the big reasons she finally has her hit in 1971, because all those people who, they recognized her voice from that tour, they went out and started buying her singles. But people like Mick Jagger were huge fans of hers all through the 60s.
So that powerful bottled lightning in the woman, in Tina Turner, at the same time, and we've got Elvis, but never mind Elvis, you've got very young male singers singing in a voice that can be extremely feminine. Little Willie John, maybe above all.
Well, Little Willie John writes a song called Fever, and he performs it, has an R&B hit with it. And, of course, Peggy Lee sort of softens it up, smooths over the edges, and makes it a popular hit. But Little Willie John's version is really the one that you want to get to know, because it really is one of the key early examples of how men in rock and roll are beginning to understand that they can tap their feminine side as a way of putting across their vulnerability and their expressivity and their emotion to attract women.
We're going to listen. Describe how young he was. He'd already had a hit, what, all around the world in 55?
That's right. And this song is 1956.
And here is Fever, Little Willie John.
Get a feeling that's so hard to bear. You give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight, fever in the morning, fever all through the night.
Little Willie John with Fever in 1956. Now you're saying listen to that kind of boyish adolescence edge on there. That's not all there is there. And you're putting him in the lineage of what Frankie Lyman and Neil Sedaka with some of these very high male voices.
Yeah, Lyman, it's not so much the register of his voice, it's the message of the song. The song is written by Otis Blackwell, but the interpretation is so much Little Willie John that really he owns the song. But it's really about how powerless a woman can make the man feel. I mean, and this is, again, this is an idea that's alien to the John Wayne sensibility. John Wayne is not about to say, you give me fever. I lose control.
I'm writhing. I'm vulnerable.
I lose control of all of my strength when I'm around you. But that's what the song is. The song is, I feel powerless around you. And it's about a man and men in the audience acknowledging women hold tremendous power.
But the rock and roll men turn it around. That expression of vulnerability is actually a kind of seduction in itself in the rock and roll world.
Right, exactly. And especially as we move into the 60s. Well, in the 50s, of course, you have doo-wop, but that what you're talking about that higher register that men begin singing in doo-wop, you have all these bird names, bird groups, right? The flamingos and the, and they're all singing in their high falsetto. And that's a way of wooing, you know, like I'm tapping my feminine side. I think the woman, the idea of the woman is so beautiful, I want to try and imitate it in order to woo it, to come over. So it's this very strong current in rock and roll. And in the 60s, you get people like Brian Wilson singing in high falsetto and adopting that as another way of doing it.
But ultimately, high, medium, or low, it's that vulnerability. It can win women over. In the rock and roll world, it also ultimately can strengthen, as you say, the guy's own personal sense of manhood. This is a new dynamic.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think with our sort of a Freudian lens looking back on the John Wayne stereotype, we see how, you know, the repression of his femininity was probably, you know, not the healthiest aspect of that whole macho rule book that he was toting.
Well, that all turned around in a hurry. We're talking tonight about the gender-bending legacy of rock and roll, how a music revolution changed the way men and women saw each other and themselves. My guest is Tim Riley, author of Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. Here from 1963, Smokey Robinson with You Can't Let the Boy Overpower the Man in You. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
But you will.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. There's The Who from 1967 with Tattoo. We're talking tonight with Tim Riley. He's author of the new book, Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you see it? Do you buy it? Do you hear it? Do you credit Elvis and Tina and Smokey and Mick with unlocking gender roles in America? Women, when you heard Proud Mary, did it give you a glimpse of a bigger way of being feminine? And men, when Elvis shook it like a Polaroid picture, did it make all men more free? What was it about rock that gave artists and finally the country the permission, the cover, to step away from old gender roles? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tim Riley, here's The Who in your lineup. Where do they fall? Where do they fit?
Well, in the 60s, we see sort of the ongoing development of a lot of these themes that Elvis and Tina introduced in the 50s, and that is a growing confusion about malehood. In other words, men are they really want to latch onto this new idea of manhood, but there's a lot of confusion and a lot of diversification about how best to do that and where it's all going to land.
What's the idea of manhood, masculinity, by that point, later in the 60s, that you're talking about?
Well, you have these new role models in the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Bob Dylan. You want to see men want to be men of ideas and men of action. You know, there's a lot of the civil rights era, social protest. It's an idea of manhood that takes ideas and involves it in a central piece of their lives and the way they behave and the things they commit themselves to. The reason that I smile when I hear this song Tattoo is that it's so gentle and humorous. It's getting exactly at the core of what that confusion is all about. What makes a man a man? Is it brain or brawn or the month you were born? It's like, how do I be a man? And one of the things that gets expressed very eloquently by Pete Townshend of The Who in a lot of his songs, two rock operas, Tommy and Quadrophenia, in the early 70s, is we don't have any role models for these new gender styles that we're trying to engage in and make whole and move from adolescence into adulthood. We have a ton of confusion about how to move this adolescent man into adulthood because we don't have a roadmap.
Let me ask you about that. I wonder if it's possible that rock and roll's own roots made that difficult. I mean, Elvis Presley, as you describe Elvis, you know, pointing toward a new ideal man for the modern era. But the man you describe, a new style of manhood, established adolescent fun, you say, risk-taking, and sexual exploration as positive values in themselves, as well as necessary pathways toward adulthood. I mean, you know, rock and roll comes with a kind of checkered reputation. I mean, you're putting it in very positive terms about femininity, masculinity, parenthood, personhood, citizenship. But this the Presley imprint here, permanently sort of affiliating, associating, and celebrating adolescence, risk-taking, sexual exploration with manhood, well, not exactly celebrated on all sides.
Well, no, of course not celebrated on all sides, but I think rock and roll sort of gets too many hits and gets too many people sort of, it turns into the whipping post for a lot of cultural ills when it's only partially responsible and people think it's an all-negative thing when there's actually, it's very multifaceted.
But
it's
I guess
a lot
what I'm asking,
more complicated.
Sure, I buy that. I mean, we got over, you know, rock and roll is the devil's music. That's behind us. But that kind of adolescent imprint, was that a way station in the evolution of the rock and roll idea of manhood or femininity for that matter? Or was that a permanent feature of it?
Well, I think that there are certainly some rock and rollers. I mean, Mick Jagger is certainly sort of, in my mind, one of those people who's trying to extend adolescence as long as he can, mainly because he can, unlike a lot of people in his audience. And I think there's definitely dangers there. But I think that what you're hearing in a song called Tattoo or in Pete Townshend's work in general is, you know, exactly what pieces of adolescence do I want to bring along into adulthood? And when do adulthood responsibilities and ideas about how I really want to live my life, when do those start to change? And what pieces do I have to give up? What pieces do I want to give up? What pieces do I want to carry on through? You forget, the key metaphor in the 60s is freedom. There are so many different ideas of freedom alive in the 60s. You know, freedom for black people to vote, freedom for young people to resist a war that they disagree with, freedom for, you know, people to gather together and listen to whatever kind of music they want. And we're going to gather together, and 500,000 of us are going to choose rock and roll at Woodstock in a tremendous statement of solidarity and communality. And, you know, that's going to become a political act. So this idea of freedom, we want to stick to freedom from our adolescence. We want to carry that into adulthood. We don't want anyone to tell us how we should live our lives, how we should wear our hair, what kind of clothes we should wear, what kind of music we should listen to. How do we bring all of that back to manhood? What kind of man do I want to be?
And not only manhood. I mean, women are
playing and singing feminism, too. See, I mean, you can trace feminism straight to rock and roll. I mean, I think Tina Turner is the first feminist and expresses feminist
energy. Tina Turner as the first feminist in what world? In the pop world, you're saying?
I think in the world.
A few suffragettes might take issue.
The Sexual Mystique in 1962, the Betty Friedan book. Before that book comes along and expresses sort of the ambivalence and the depressive end of housewifery in America, we have Tina Turner singing in 1960, "How come I'm in love with this guy when he treats me so mean?" That's a fool in love in 1960. And she spends her whole career working out the theme of that song, which is, I'm a woman, I'm fierce, I'm proud, I'm independent, I've got to break free from this man. By the way, the man who wrote the song, Ike Turner, you know, sort of the central irony of that recording. All of these ideas of freedom very much alive in the music. But if you have feminists like Tina Turner, I think if you're Pete Townsend, you say, well, if Tina Turner gets to be that fierce and independent, what does that mean for my manhood? Of course, I'm drawn to that fierceness and that independence, but what does that mean for me as a man? And there's a lot of confusion, a lot of flailing about in the 60s of exactly what this idea of manhood is all supposed to be about. And of course, the irony is that in expressing all that confusion about manhood, some of it sticks. They find different ways of becoming mature adults and men and saving some of those liberating aspects that they encountered in adolescence and moving into more healthy ideas about manhood that take some of what John Wayne had to offer and reject some of what John... So it becomes a more balanced, a more nuanced kind of composition.
But in a field freed up, you're saying, in no small part by the rock and roll culture itself, by 1980, we get some very different vectors coming through here. Stop Your Sobbing, The Pretenders. Let's listen to this. Here we get into some gender roles being turned on their head.
Well, exactly. I mean, by 1980, Chrissy Hynde is starting to be a lead person in a rock and roll.
Let's hear it.
Yes, it's time you do.
There's one thing you gotta do to make me still want you.
Gotta stop seven hours.
Gotta stop seven hours.
The Pretenders in 1980 and Chrissy Hynde telling the man to stop your sobbing. We've come to a new spot here.
Well, exactly. She's notorious for going to... She's raised in Ohio. She goes to Britain to be a rock critic and chase her idol, Ray Davies. And she recovers this Ray Davies song on an early Pretenders album. And it completely reverses the whole macho scenario that the song is originally about. You know, stop your sobbing, I'm tired of watching you. It refers to the old Robert Johnson song, Stop Breaking Down. But when Chrissy Hynde sings it, she's singing it to a lover, to a man, and it's kind of like, hey, you know, stop being a baby. And the genius is in the simplicity of it. In that simple reversal, she sums up a huge amount of feminist anger. And, of course, the other reason that Chrissy Hynde is so important is that she fronts a guitar band of men, and she makes it look like it's something so natural, something that existed long before her and should have been around, and, you know, probably should have been around long before her. But she's the first one, and there's no other one, and she's done it for so long. But she commands a men's guitar band in rock and roll better than many men command guitar bands in rock and roll.
And as you say here, she's covering a song written by a man. I wonder about that dynamic itself. I mean, this era of 2 and 3 and 4 minute songs, written and then maybe by a man or a woman, and then covered by an artist of the opposite gender.
Yeah.
We change a few pronouns, and presto, meaning gets changed in very interesting ways. I wonder if that that kind of pattern itself, just covering, men covering women's songs, women covering men's songs, isn't just a structural way of busting up the field.
Well, absolutely it is. It's one of the key ways. In fact, one of the songs that I trace throughout this book, Fever, is the song Fever itself, which gets covered by different people. And we talked about Little Willie John and Peggy Lee, but Elvis Presley also sings that song and gives it a very different sort of twist than Little Willie John. Madonna covers the song Fever. Bruce Springsteen, and I wind up with a big chapter on Bruce Springsteen at the end of this book, he writes his own song called The Fever, which is clearly a tribute to the Little Willie John song. And so you have this, again, the dialogue I was talking about, the back and forth. I'm going to be a new kind of man. I'm going to be a new kind of woman. Well, what kind of, what does that mean for my manhood? You know, and the whole conversation that goes back and forth there is what was very interesting to trace through these songs.
We're going to hear more music. I want to invite our callers in. We're talking tonight with Tim Riley. He's author of Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. What was it? What is it about rock that gave artists and finally the culture, the permission, the cover, to step away from old gender roles? Do you agree that rock did it, made it happen? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dave is calling from Hyannis, Massachusetts. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Dave.
Okay. I'm a little put off by the terminology of masculinity and femininity and what that implies. Tina Turner is an extremely feminine woman. And Elvis Presley, there isn't anything feminine about him. He is masculine. He is a man. I deal with students at several universities in Boston, and I deal with a lot of high school kids who a few of them, are very worried about what does it mean if I'm a woman, and if I really feel the urge to assert myself, that somehow that means that maybe I am gay when I don't think I am, and I certainly have no issues or concerns.
Dave, we've got it. Let me just put this to you. I mean, who would disagree today in 2004, looking at Tina Turner? Wow, what a woman. Or Elvis Presley, what a man. But if you put yourselves in the headset of pre-rock and roll, of, I don't know, 1949, 1950, and saw this big, strong, powerful woman, isn't that the proof of the change, of the evolution Tim Riley's describing?
And that's feminine. And that doesn't mean that she is masculine. She is just a liberated female.
Amen. But it's kind of a new definition of femininity that Tim Riley is saying rock and roll helped sweep in. Tim, what do you say?
Well, absolutely, it's feminine. I mean, and that's sort of the new turf that she carved out, you know, with her blazing femininity. I mean, that's the way we think of it. But I think your point is right. With 1949 ears, this would have been radical. This would have been completely radical. But you have to understand, this is part of the measure of the shakeup that was so successful with rock and roll, to the point where now, I mean, we have, you know, an acceptance and an embrace of gay rights and politics, gay marriage. I mean, this would be unthinkable 40 years ago. Unthinkable. But rock and roll is a prime mover in that whole progression.
So Tina ends up defining a new kind of very robust and wonderful femininity. Elvis, a new kind of masculinity with a whole lot more range. But it's interesting, if you listen to what Dave's saying, he's thinking about young people listening to what we're saying right here, and still sensitive, though, in 2004, that they may see that strong woman or may understand it as being described as
fear,
other than feminine, or the sensitive
gay,
man
right.
as other than male. That would suggest maybe rock and roll, maybe the lasting imprint isn't as deep as you might think, Tim.
Well, you know, what
kids are still kind of wondering.
I think the larger picture, the big gestalt theory behind all of this, is that what rock and roll taught us is that there's a great deal of femininity involved in healthy masculinity. And there's a great deal of masculinity involved in healthy femininity. And I mean that
they're not mutually exclusive. They each fit into the other.
That it's every one of us is finding the balance that's right for us, okay? And that what Elvis Presley and Tina Turner did was they showed incredible, radical, in terms of the culture, imbalances that they were asserting, this balance fits me, this suits me.
Change the norm.
This tender side for me, I feel I want to be gushy like this. I don't want to have to hold this in. And that was a balance that was right for him. And it gave a lot of other men the permission to do the same.
And yet it is interesting that all these years later, we still hear that, oh, I don't know kind of feeling from Dave. Though clearly, yes, Tina Turner is feminine. Holy smokes, we take it. I want to listen to Joni Mitchell, 1980, another cover, Why Do Fools Fall in Love? Let's just listen for a moment. From the 1980 live album, Shadows and Light, Joni Mitchell. Okay, Tim Riley, I have to admit I had forgotten that Joni Mitchell covered this.
Well, not many people know that she covered it. I think it was not released on an album. I think it's released only on a live DVD of that album.
Okay, got it.
And what's great about it, I mean, it's just rapturous. And it's, you know, it's her paying her respects to the original singer of that song, Frankie Lyman, who was one of the early child stars of doo-wop. Mm. And a remarkable figure because he had more talent bursting out of his body. I mean, before there was Michael Jackson, there was Frankie Lyman. He was the kid who was able to sing a song like Why Do Fools Fall in Love. And even though he was a boy, and you could tell you were never going to mistake him for a woman, he sang this song with such rapture and with such ease and control that it made you think that he understood secrets of romance that adults would be chasing for life. I mean, he really had a magical kind of charisma and a checkered career and a sort of a tragic story, but one of the great signal rock and roll recordings of the 50s. And that Joni Mitchell, who's our signal feminist singer-songwriter of the early 70s, circles around and covers that song.
Says, hey, shows, Frankie, we remember you.
Shows that she's very in touch with these gender roles. She's very in touch with the gender role that she occupied and carried in the early 70s, and that she's paying her respects to Frankie Lyman. I love that track.
It's pretty great. We're going to go out of this segment with Bruce Springsteen, Walk Like a Man, from his 87 album, Tunnel of Love, a song about Springsteen's relationship with his father and growing up to be a man. We'll come back and talk about Bruce Springsteen. We're looking tonight at the gender role revolution in rock and roll. How a music revolution changed the way men and women saw each other and themselves. Tim Riley is my guest. His new book is Fever. You can join the conversation tonight. What about the other side of rock, the side that reinforced old roles? And who in pop music is bending gender boundaries today? Where are they moving? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Goodbye, Lady of the Roses. We lived in the shadow of the hills. I remember Ma dragging me and my sister up the street to the church whenever she heard those old wedding bells. Well, would they ever look so...
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Tim Riley, author of Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America, here from 96, Roseanne Cash, If I Were a Man.
So sweet, that give me everything I need. I'd be so glad to go this deep if I were a man. If I were the moon, I'd hang so low. Bring sweet love to all below. I wouldn't change and hurt you so if I were the moon.
Roseanne Cash, 1996, of course, the daughter of the great Johnny Cash. A song about how all she would change if she were a man. If I were a man, I'd be so sweet. She sings, Tim Riley, talk about Roseanne Cash and talk about Bruce Springsteen, who we heard on the out of the last
walk
segment.
Like a man. Well, the Roseanne Cash song to me, it's such a beautiful song, and it's so rueful. I mean, it really does measure a lot of, like, you know, there's been a lot of strides made in terms of feminism and in terms of the feminization of men and everything, and yet there's still so far to go. That's what I hear in this song. I mean, she can sing as late as 1996, "If I Were a Man," you know, how tender I would be towards the world, how many things I would try and change, I mean, and how much power she would have if she were a man. I mean, it is really a barometer of how far we have to go, I think.
And what about the boss, Springsteen? He's the guy in always the working man's blue jeans and those cowboy boots and the rolled up black T-shirt sleeves. The visuals are not new man.
That's true. It is kind of that he adopts some of the costumery of the old John Wayne, but he is definitely the successor to Elvis Presley. He's definitely a new kind of man. He's put together a completely different kind of career than any other entertainment figure in history, and it's a large part of it. The themes in his song, he's all devoted to manhood and what this new idea of man is all about, and how complicated it has become, and how men have to sort of navigate through many thickets, many different ideas of manhood to arrive at their own strong sense of selfhood. And "Walk Like a Man" is really sort of the key symbolic song of how he works all that out for himself. "I remember how rough your hand felt on mine on my wedding day." He's singing to his father, directly to his father. Now, one of the key early themes in Springsteen's songs is his anger at his father. He has some of the most self-righteous and palpable anger in early songs, like "Adam Raised a Cain," which is all about how angry he is at the life that his father led and how different he wants to be from his father. Very important, key, central Springsteen theme. Well, you get to "Walk Like a Man," and what he's singing about very tenderly is, you know, I realize that I was very angry at you, and there's a lot about you that I respect deeply that is almost, you know, almost I can't put into words, but I was always trying to follow in your footsteps, even though I was angry, and I always wanted to be like you in certain ways and walk like a man. A beautiful, tender song from that Tunnel of Love record.
Aristotle is calling from North Reading, Massachusetts. Hi, Aristotle, you're on the air.
Thank you for accepting my call.
Sure.
I think it's a fantastic program. We could probably speak hours about it, but I have a couple of comments I'd like to make.
Yeah.
First off, I think the notion of gender and self are very closely tied to current cultural situations and the political situations. I think these things aren't new notions at all. And in fact, they're plastic and changing all the time. I think in art and music, we have seen this evolve, I think, from ancient Greece to Middle Ages to now.
So they're always changing. But does that make the change in any particular era any less significant?
No, it's not less significant, but I think it's kind of a ubiquitous phenomenon that we've seen throughout culture. Let me give you a couple great examples.
Yes, please.
Yeah, Aristophanes talks about it. Sophocles talks about it in Antigone. If you look at music, look at Wagner. If you look at Die Walküre, Brunhilde is the warrior princess.
Yeah, watch out, Tina Turner.
The first Wonder Woman was who? Brunhilde. She courted the adolescent Siegfried. How? With power, intensity. She stood up to her father. She defied him, and she was banished forever.
Aristotle, our time is short, but it's a great point, Tim Riley. You're not saying that this is the first time gender roles have ever changed, I guess.
Of course it's
rock and roll in its era with its imprint.
Yeah, no, my focus is on rock and roll, and there's obviously a lot to say about the wider realms in history. I look forward to Aristotle's book.
Absolutely.
Terrific
examples
ideas,
right there, all. So, yes, from Aristophanes right on down, it changes and changes again. I want to ask you something, though. You're talking about all these changes that rock and roll has made. If you look right now at the big theater playing out, the political drama playing out. You've got, you know, you talked about John Wayne and sort of Peggy Lee being banished before. Look at the Republican, at the First Lady and the President. George Bush looks to me back in the John Wayne mold. Laura Bush in the Peggy Lee mold. And warmly embraced by many Americans. What does that say about your thesis?
Well, it says that, that these different types are still clashing and still at war with each other. I mean, another example that I brought up was the success of the Marlboro Man, which is clearly, you know, a descendant of the John Wayne archetype and sold millions of cigarettes throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and was only retired in the 80s. And obviously a very potent animating symbol for a lot of people smoking those cigarettes. I think that these two ideas of manhood still are kind of duking it out in different ways in culture. I think that the new rock and roll man is ascendant, but that's just an opinion. I think he's overwhelmingly more healthy. And I think the John Wayne stereotype is still very much alive, and people are still it shows how much people are grasping at models to try and make sense of the idea of manhood.
But you're not worried that rock and roll man and rock and roll woman are going to be sent back into the mists of time?
No, absolutely not.
Tim Riley, fascinating. Wish we had more time. It's been a great hour. Tim Riley's new book is Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. You know, we came in with Tina Turner, and we are going to go out with her as well. The great Tina Turner, here from Tina and Ike Turner, 1971, from the album Working Together, won a Grammy for Best R&B Vocal Performance by a group. Nobody says it like Tina Turner. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. Tina Turner, take it away. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
The eastern side of the eye of the hurricane is brutal, and the barrier islands were damaged. I mean, there were reports, at least in my conversation, for example, with the sheriff of Escambia County, that entire houses were taken off their foundations and disappeared because of the storm surge.
Numerous trees, major limbs torn out, the whole front area of the lawn down to the water is still several feet underwater. Two or three sailboats and one motor yacht in the front yard. Just an incredible force.
Our medics picked up body parts scattered across the street and put them into boxes. Angry crowds gathering near the site of the blast denounced the United States and interim Iraqi Prime Minister Ayad Alawi's government for failing to protect police recruiting centers.
I have stated clearly that it was not in conformity with the Security Council, with the UN Charter.
The United Nations Security Council voted to declare to Saddam Hussein disclose, disarm, or face serious consequences. I believe when international bodies speak, they must mean what they say in order to make the world peaceful.
His own intelligence officials have warned him for weeks that the mission in Iraq is in serious trouble. That is the truth, as hard as it is to bear. In the Bible, it says it's the truth that sets you free. And in America, we are a country that has been built on our ability to take the truth and turn it around and deal with it.
And if unbelievable to me that we, after 10 years of seeing this ban, that we have to go to it again after all those years of hard work.
The only way to reclaim my life and the quality of life for all those related to me with certainty now is to serve my sentence, surrender to the authorities so that I can quickly return as soon as possible to the life and the work that I love.
Sounds of a week. Hurricane Ivan kills at least 33 and causes extensive damage in the southeastern United States. More than 250 Iraqis die in one of the bloodiest weeks this year. One bomb directed at recruits waiting outside an Iraqi police station in Baghdad. One car bomb killed 47 on Tuesday. Kofi Annan says the U.S.-led war in Iraq was illegal. President Bush disagrees. Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry says the president is not being truthful to the American people about Iraq. The assault weapons ban quietly expires. We heard the voice of Sarah Brady there. And Martha Stewart says she wants to begin her prison term immediately rather than waiting for her appeal to be heard. Jack Beatty, what a fascinating week. The presidential campaign now, a kind of debate or fight over what's real, over reality itself. What's true?
Yes, it is. That's very true. I mean, John Kerry is trying to give the impression that President Bush is somewhere between a fool, that is someone who acts on things that aren't so and who just believes them no matter what the evidence shows. In fact, he says, you can even say that George Bush is proud of the fact that not even failure can cause him to change his mind. So on one hand, he's a fool. On the other hand, he's a political trimmer. He's Lyndon B. Bush. He gets an intelligence report telling him just how dire the future is apt to be, and that's not what he tells the people.
Well, John Kerry may be right, and he may be wrong, but when George Bush stood before the National Guard in Las Vegas and gave his stump speech, he got a whole of a lot more applause than John Kerry got, saying, I will tell you the truth.
These people are you know, they bought into the whole Bush worldview. And in fact, someone says the president can't be lying. Well, we know from too much history that presidents lie. They lie all the time. President Bush was lying, it seems to me, this week when he said that John Kerry wants to nationalize health care. In fact, according to experts, President Bush's plan is more interventionist. Now, you can say, well, that's just a political claim. But, boy, it's again, credibility is the issue. Then it comes out, according to Paul Krugman, an economist he quotes, Bush wants to balance the budget in 4 or 5 years. On the other hand, he wants to make the tax cuts permanent. Well, the only way the budget can be balanced is if Bush's legislative program, namely making the tax cut permanent, doesn't pass.
You say credibility is the issue, but of course, it's obvious, I guess, that people are defining even credibility in different ways. To many Americans, President Bush seems very credible when he says, I will be stalwart, I will be strong, there's no turning back, I will do everything to defend this country. And that rings to many, clearly, if the polls have it right, as credibility.
It does, but, you know, reality is out there. 1,025, 26, 27 dead Americans, 3,186 dead Iraqi civilians just since April, both from our fire and from terrorist fire. Those are realities, and that's going to keep up. And I think the question for Americans is, how long should this go on? You know, how long will these streams of death go on? And which of these candidates is going to be, both of them are for it, both of them are continuing the occupation. But if this keeps up, Americans have to ask which of them is going to keep the war going longer, which of them will keep this stream of death going on longer.
Remarkable polls out just in the last couple of days, some that show the race neck and neck again, others that show George Bush with a very big lead. They sort of negate each other. We have no idea at this point.
We don't. We're flying blind, and all sorts of people are coming out and saying that the polling is not the instrument it used to be, that this metric likely voter is extremely squishy, and that for all sorts of reasons, sometimes even the weather, Florida, for example, hasn't been represented in these polls. We're getting skewed samples, but there seemed to be a consensus that the bounce either had disappeared, the Bush bounce, or was coming down. And one just doesn't know how long that'll go, or maybe it'll just stabilize right where it is now.
But it began to feel this week, maybe for the first time to me, Jack, that these two contestants are closing on each other now with this debate over what is reality, the debate before Americans on defining that itself.
I think that's true, and we're going to see it in the debate. And I think John Kerry is going to turn on them and say, you know, what you say is real is not so. And Mr. Bush is going to say, I believe what I believe.
And then it boils down to who Americans believe. And maybe on that will hinge the election. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.